is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Deadline's reports emerging of the U.S. forces transferring hundreds of Daesh terrorists from a prison in northeast Syria to a desert near Iraq's border. Iran's president tells his French counterpart that any agreement to revive the JCPOA should include verification of sanctions removal and reliable guarantees. North Korea reportedly carries out its longest-range missile test since 2017 as denuclearization talks with Seoul and Washington remain stalled.
Welcome to the program.
New reports emerging of the U.S. role in northeastern Syria. American forces have transferred 750 Daesh terrorists, most of them foreigners, from a prison in Hasaka province. Russian media are quoting special sources as saying that the detainees have been transferred to a desert in Deir ez-Zor province. They say U.S. coalition drones carried out monitoring operations to secure their exit route until they arrived at their destination near the town of Bukamal. Sources say the transfer process took place in batches via SUVs and buses. It says a number of top Daesh leaders who hold Arab, Belgian, and Dutch nationalities were among the escapees. Last week, Daesh attacked the detention center. Heavy fighting ensued. Kurdish-led forces, who are allies of the U.S. and fighting the Syrian government, run the prison. Syria's UN envoy has blamed Washington for the clashes. Bassam Sabbab says U.S. is seeking to recycle Daesh and justify American military presence in Syria. Syrian government has initiated a reconciliation process for towns and villages in southern Damascus countryside. This is an implementation of the state's strategy to restore peace and normal life to areas that previously witnessed violence across the country. Our Syria correspondent, Hamid Ali, reports.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There is an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
The Yemeni army says its forces have downed another spy drone belonging to Saudi-led forces in Ma'arib province. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says Yemeni air defenses downed the Scan Eagle drone while flying over Ma'arib's Juba district. This comes hours after the Saudi-led military coalition conducted dozens of airstrikes in Yemen. Riyadh launched a devastating war against its impoverished southern neighbor in 2015. The conflict, coupled with a crippling blockade, has triggered a severe humanitarian crisis in the country. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, but Yemeni forces say they will continue their resistance until the Saudi aggression ends. Dozens of Palestinians protested near the separation fence in the Gaza Strip to voice their support for Palestinians in Al-Nuqab, who are facing a violent wave of land grabbing by the Israeli apartheid regime.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a rally near the separation fence between Gaza and the occupied lands. The rally comes to voice the Palestinian outrage of the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. Al-Naqab is witnessing a wave of forced displacement by Israel's system of apartheid against all Palestinians. Considering these Israeli attempts to expel thousands of Palestinians from their homes and lands a crime against humanity, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip expressed their support to Palestinians in Al-Naqab, south of the country.
The Israeli regime has stolen our land since 1948. Until this moment, it keeps practicing apartheid attempts to take our lands by force. My words for Palestinians in Al-Naqab is that we will always be supported and we are all united in the face of this aggression.
In their speeches, Palestinian factions stressed that the issue of Al-Naqab is the issue of every Palestinian and they won't sit idle in the face of these illegal crimes.
This event is organized by the national and the Islamic forces in Gaza and all the Palestinian tribesmen in order to express our support to our people in Al-Naqab, who are under the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. Israel wants to expel those people from their lands and homes, and this is unacceptable for us. We are together until breaking the Zionist Bennett, who threatened to build an iron wall around our people in Al-Naqab.
Calling it an ongoing Nakba, hundreds of Palestinian citizens demonstrated in Al-Naqab, while dozens of them were arrested by the Israeli regime. The number of Arab citizens in Al-Naqab is estimated at 300,000, living on 5% of the land, of which they said that Israel had confiscated 95% since 1948. Al-Naqab has seen a dramatic escalation as the Israeli regime intensifies its apartheid policies of seizing the Palestinian lands. Palestinians here stress that Al-Naqab is not alone in this struggle. They also say they won't remain silent in this battle against the Israeli crimes. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Israeli President Isaac Herzog is set to land in the United Arab Emirates for talks with leaders of the Arab country. It's the first such trip by an Israeli president. Herzog will be meeting top Emirati officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, the UAE, along with the Bahrain, established diplomatic relations with Israel 2 years ago in U.S. brokered deals. Palestinians see normalization as a stab in their back, Israeli media say. Herzog will use his 2-day stay to encourage more Persian Gulf Arab nations to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. The trip follows on the heels of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's visit in December. In other news, Iran's president says his country has proven its will and seriousness in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ebrahim Raisi said verifiable removal of anti-Iran sanctions will provide the basis for an agreement. He said the other negotiating parties must provide guarantees that they will not withdraw from the pact in the future. Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with his French counterpart. Emmanuel Macron, for his part, said Iran has the right to distrust the United States, as it was Washington that threw the JCPOA into disarray. He was referring to the unilateral withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal in 2018. Iran and the remaining parties have been trying to revive the agreement. Britain, France, and Germany say the talks are in their final stages and that political decisions need to be made now. Earlier, I spoke to author and journalist Robert Fantina to get his take on efforts to resurrect Iran's 2015 agreement. The Ontario-based analyst says the U.S. needs to show good faith to help bring the tattered deal back to life.
With these latest remarks and the fact that the other signatories are saying that it's time for political decisions and that, as you said, we're entering a new phase, it is time to conclude this. But the conclusion will come about when the United States decides to remove all the sanctions before Iran makes any efforts to reduce its nuclear enrichment, because it is the United States that violated the agreement. Those are the political decisions that must be made on the part of the U.S. and the part of the other signatories. Part of Iran's major concern is having an assurance that the United States will not once again unilaterally withdraw, and yet members of the U.S. Congress are saying they're going to do exactly that. So the U.S., if it wants to reinstate the JCPOA, which around the world was considered a positive agreement, there are going to have to be some major concessions by the United States to show its good faith. The government of Iran has already showed its good faith and goodwill by maintaining the agreement for a full year afterwards. The United States has done nothing but show bad faith, and it's proven that it cannot be trusted.
South Korea says the North has fired an intermediate-range missile amid Pyongyang's missile tests in recent weeks. Japanese Coast Guard says North Korea appeared to have fired a ballistic missile, which landed outside Japan's exclusive economic zone. Seoul says North Korea has taken a step closer to abandoning its self-imposed moratorium on testing long-range missiles. President Moon Jae-in also called on North Korea to stop creating tensions and to return to talks. Meanwhile, Tokyo slammed a series of missile launches as a violation of UN resolutions. If confirmed, this would be North Korea's 7th missile launch this year. North Korea, on the other hand, says its missile tests are an exercise of its right to self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, has given us the backdrop of North Korea's recent series of missile tests. Take a listen.
This month, we have seen the highest number of missile tests by North Korea since the current leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, took power in late 2011 upon the death of his father. The previous records were held in March and July 2014, when the North Korean government conducted 6 projectile months tests in those months. Now, this 7th intermediate-range ballistic missile test flew further than the previous ballistic missile tests that North Korea conducted this month. And that's why people are afraid that North Korea is going to abandon its self-imposed moratorium on nuclear and long-range missile testing. The North has been heavily sanctioned under the U.S. Biden administration. The nuclear talks are not going anywhere. And meanwhile, the U.S. and South Korean military allies are holding drills preparing to invade North Korea if necessary. In fact, the conservative presidential candidate who is going to be running for president and get possibly elected on March 9th has said he is going to possibly do some sort of a preemptive bloody nose strike on North Korean nuclear and missile facilities if he wins the presidential election. So the North has to do something. It cannot just sit there and do nothing. And that's why it did this intermediate range ballistic missile test.
The UK is planning to commit more forces and weapons to the NATO alliance for deployment in Eastern Europe amid rising tensions with Russia over Ukraine. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the move will send a clear message to the Kremlin that London will not tolerate what he described as Moscow's destabilizing activities. The offer will be made to NATO military chiefs next week. The deployment will include warships, jets, as well as military equipment. Britain may also double its forces in Eastern European countries from the current 1,150. Relations between Russia and the West are at their lowest point since the Cold War. NATO insists that Russia has deployed tens of thousands of troops on the border in preparation for an invasion of Ukraine. Moscow says it has the right to move forces on its soil because its security is at risk from NATO's eastward enlargement and military activities. Sergio Mattarella has been re-elected Italy's president after Republic ending a week of political squabbling among party leaders. Mattarella's acceptance to stay for a second mandate has pulled the country out of a quagmire that would otherwise erode the government's credibility. Take a look, please.
Mattarella. Mattarella.
After 6 days of failed votes and 8 rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility. The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis. Commentators have slammed political leaders for their bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences. Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful,
the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps, and seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The limelight.
The U.S. State Department recently approved a sprawling $2.5 billion arms sales to Egypt, even as the Biden administration continues to withhold a far smaller sum of military aid, $130 million, over expressed concerns about human rights abuses by the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, a disconnect that critics said makes a mockery of U.S. leaders' rhetoric. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, journalist of the Truth Out website. This article is published under the heading, Biden OKs $2.5 billion arms sales to Egypt, disregarding government oppression. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. State Department recently approved a sprawling $2.5 billion arms sales to Egypt, even as the Biden administration continues to withhold a far smaller sum of military aid, $130 million, over expressed concerns about human rights abuses by by the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. A disconnect that critics said makes a mockery of U.S. leaders' rhetoric. Authorized on the 11th anniversary of the 2011 Egyptian Revolution, the weapon sales includes 12 Super Hercules C-130 transport aircraft, as well as $355 million worth of air defense radar systems. Nothing says the U.S. doesn't care about your government's oppression quite like announcing $2.5 billion in arms sales to Egypt on the anniversary of the January 25th revolution. Ben Freeman, a research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, wrote in response to the news. Andrew Strolane, European Media Director for Human Rights Watch, said the Biden administration is encouraging and assisting Egypt's torturers by moving to funnel more arms to the authoritarian Assisi government. In September, as Common Dreams reported, Biden administration officials announced their decision to provide Egypt with $170 million in military aid, while withholding $130 million until the government meets certain human rights criteria, including ending its crackdown on political dissidents and activists. Egypt was given a January 30, 2022 deadline to comply with the administration's conditions. If human rights were truly the center of our foreign policy, we wouldn't be selling nearly $1.2 billion in weapons to one of the worst human rights abusers in the world, Representative Ilhan Omar tweeted at the time, referring to earlier U.S. arms arrangements with Egypt. During a press briefing recently, Associated Press reporter Matt Lee pushed State Department spokesperson Ned Price on the seeming incoherence of withholding $130 million on human rights grounds while greenlighting a massive sale of high-tech weaponry to the same brutal government. Lee asked, what is the point of withholding $130 million in foreign military financing when you're just going to turn around and sell them $2.5 billion in weapons? Price dodged the question, telling Lee that if we have anything to add on that, we will let you know. Recently, Representatives Don Beyer and Tom Maliwonski, co-chairs of Congress's Egypt Human Rights Caucus, issued a statement urging the Biden administration not to release the $130 million in military aid, warning that the Assisi government has continued to engage in widespread torture, suppression of dissent, and even persecution of American citizens and the families of critics living in the United States. The lawmakers added, holding firm on the conditions would be consistent with President Biden's campaign commitments of no more blank checks for the Egyptian military regime.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
communique.
A new front has opened in the war on Yemen. Yemen's National Salvation Government, using missiles and drones, carried out a successful strike all the way in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates. As you know, the UAE is part of the Saudi-led coalition that's been committing genocide in Yemen for 7 years in an attempt to overthrow the Popular Salvation Government, also known as the Houthis or Ansar Allah. In 2019, the Emirates withdrew some of its troops from Yemen, appearing to decrease its involvement in the war. But the UAE is still very much involved. It's been working hand in glove with Saudi Arabia, butchering the people of Yemen. And all the while, their beloved capital, Abu Dhabi, prides itself in being a safe, fashionable, and rich destination to work, live, and travel for foreigners and expats. But now, the game has changed, because this is the first time that the war has really come to the UAE's doorstep. So why is this strike so significant? What does it say about Yemen's military capabilities? Is it just a one-off success for the Salvation Government, or a real game changer? Saudi Arabia's allies, like the United States, were very quick to condemn the attack. So how come they said nothing when Saudi Arabia subsequently launched a wave of airstrikes on Yemen, killing hundreds and even knocking out public infrastructure? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Since 2015, Yemen has been under constant attack from Saudi Arabia and its coalition. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed as a result, the vast majority of them civilians. This war has been openly and brazenly supported by the West. The United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Canada have all profited greatly from killing Yemenis, selling boatloads of weapons to Saudi Arabia and its allies. The US and UK in particular have played a considerable role, providing intelligence, logistical support, refueling, and much more to the Saudi-led coalition. This has resulted in Yemenis being killed either by conventional armaments or from malnourishment, disease, and other ailments brought on by Saudi Arabia's destruction of Yemeni public infrastructure and the blockade of Yemen, which has been in place since 2015. Things are so bad that the United Nations has described the situation in Yemen as the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with 21 million Yemenis in need of humanitarian assistance. And while the Saudi-led coalition has enjoyed high-tech military equipment and logistical support and intelligence from the Americans, the Yemeni National Salvation Government has turned the war into a quagmire for them. In the beginning, the Saudis thought they could easily overrun Yemen and put the overthrown president, Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi, back in power. But the Saudis miscalculated. And not only they miscalculated, but so did the Emiratis, who've helped them attack Yemen. They thought the conflict would stay far away from their borders and be confined just to Yemen. But that has changed. On January 17, 2022, the Yemen Salvation Government struck Abu Dhabi, the UAE's capital. Using a combination of drones and missiles, two different targets were hit. The first, an oil facility in Musafa, and the second, a construction site at Abu Dhabi's international airport. Both places were set ablaze by the attack. Despite pulling back its troops, the UAE is still in the war and has been using its so-called Giants Brigade to push Yemen's National Salvation Government out of strategic locations like Shebwa and the oil-rich province of Ma'rib. Now, considering the technological and military upper hand that the Saudi coalition has enjoyed, due largely to all the equipment provided by the US and co., it's frankly quite remarkable that the Yemenis were able to strike so far away and so deep within Emirati territory. Not many people expected that, least of all, the Emiratis. This attack must have really caught them off guard and angered them, because what ensued were the deadliest attacks on the Yemeni capital of Sana'a since 2019. The Saudi-led coalition spent several days pounding the capital and other cities, killing scores of civilians. On January 18, 2022, the Saudi-led coalition killed 20 people when it bombed Sana'a. 2 days later, on January 20th, a football stadium in Hodeidah Governorate was struck as a kids' football team was playing. 4 children were killed and 13 wounded. The latest and deadliest attack came on January 21st, when Saudi planes bombed a detention center in Sa'da, killing at least 70 people. Inmates, the bulk of the victims, could be seen desperately trying to get out from under the rubble. And later the same day, there was another strike on the port city of Hodeidah, which took out a telecommunications center critical to Yemen's internet. As a result, Yemen's entire internet connection was taken offline. A second guest who was set to join us here on the program was unable to make it as a result. Now, bombing civilian infrastructure is considered a war crime under international law. How does an entire country have its internet connection blown up using U.S.-made weapons, and yet the media says absolutely nothing? How is this not a front-page news story? All the media do is talk about Iran-backed Houthi rebels as if people in Yemen are too stupid to govern themselves or exercise self-determination. Like, all the decisions in Yemen must come from Iran. And the same thing in Iraq, right? If you're sick of Americans occupying your land and you resist, which is your right under international law, then you must be Iran-backed. Why don't they call the Saudi-led coalition U.S.-backed? The United States have given far more support, literally hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons to the Saudis and their friends. More support than Iran has ever given to the Yemenis. Do you know what the reaction to this deadly strike was? U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken posted on Twitter that he had spoken with Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Faisal bin Farhan, to, quote, reiterate our commitment to bolster the defense capabilities of Saudi Arabia and Gulf partners while mitigating civilian harm. Apparently, Blinken's idea of mitigating civilian harm is selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which are used to kill Yemeni civilians. Perhaps Blinken's idea of bolstering Saudi Arabia's defense capabilities means blowing up detention centers, killing prisoners, and taking Yemen's internet offline. Oh yeah, that sounds very defensive indeed. Again, Blinken tweeted this just a few hours after Saudi Arabia's airstrikes. The timing is not an accident. It's very clear. He knows perfectly well what Saudi Arabia just did, what Saudi Arabia has been doing for years. And instead of condemning this massacre, never mind cutting off arms sales, he doubles down and says that the United States will keep on giving the Saudis weapons so they can defend themselves. Defend themselves from what? Civilians? Prisoners in their cells? Yemen's internet connection? When Yemen carried out its strike on Abu Dhabi, the West condemned it immediately. The State Department put out a statement saying it condemns these terrorist attacks. Blinken tweeted his condolences to the victims. But when Saudi Arabia takes out vital civilian infrastructure and kills dozens, dozens, dozens more people, like it has been for years, it's crickets. All of a sudden, they don't know how to condemn violent, heinous acts anymore because they don't want to upset their little friend Saudi Arabia. All these hypocrites who dress up in their nice suits, complete silence, right? All these people in their suits who pretend to care about human rights, crickets. Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, was asked if the Biden administration would condemn the attack by Saudi Arabia, just like they were quick to condemn the Yemeni attack on Abu Dhabi. As you can imagine, as expected, there was no condemnation, just a spineless, rubbish answer.
What's the administration's immediate reaction to this strike, and does this prompt any reconsideration of weapon sales to Saudi Arabia?
I don't have any prediction of that at this point in time. Obviously, we have a long history of a relationship with Saudi Arabia, one where we raise issues where we have significant concerns on human rights and on a range of issues, and one where we have had a long security relationship that has been in the interest of the United States. In terms of this specific strike and a reaction, obviously any time there's a loss of life, of innocent lives, that is a tragedy, and we are mindful of that and focused on that.
After the strike on Abu Dhabi, after Yemen was defending itself, U.S. President Joe Biden had the gall to say that he was considering redesignating the Yemen Salvation Government a foreign terrorist organization.
That you declared when you came to office was to end the war in Yemen, that catastrophic war in Yemen. You appointed a special envoy. Today, one of your allies, United Arab Emirates, is asking your administration to put back the Houthi rebels or militias back on the terror list. Are you going to do that? And how are you going to end the war in Yemen, sir?
The answer is it's under consideration, and ending the war in Yemen takes the two parties to be involved to do it, and it's going to be very difficult.
And this is what Donald Trump did right before he left office. Remember, he and then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who ran wild slapping people with sanctions as part of their maximum pressure campaign, they went and targeted Yemen. As a result, there was a real fear that an even bigger famine would ensue. People in Yemen are so undernourished as a result of the Saudi coalition's bombings and blockade. Most of the food in Yemen is imported through traders, and by sanctioning Yemen, this effectively means that no one would want to do business anymore for fear of U.S. reprisal, and that food would stop flowing in. According to the United Nations, Yemen is going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Food and medical supplies are low, compounding these tragedies and making it even harder to recover and to help those who are wounded by these strikes. Now, Joe Biden did reverse this designation after taking office, but for how long, if he's considering slapping on the terrorist label again? Biden also claimed that he will be ending the war in Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
Obviously, that was a lie. Look at the massacres that just took place. The U.S. is still giving Saudi Arabia weapons. It just calls them defensive weapons now, as if that makes a difference. They're still killing Yemenis in the end, and the arms dealers are still making money. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now, joining me to further discuss the situation in Yemen is Yasser Al-Muhallil. He is a Yemeni journalist currently based in Damascus. And Yasser, first of all, thank you for coming on the program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for hosting.
Could I just get your immediate reaction to what's happening in Yemen, a wave of Saudi strikes the entire week? What is your initial reaction?
Yes. As you know, in the recent days, United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia just tried to intensify their operations on the ground. So they tried to take over several areas in Shabwa district, which is in the south of Yemen. And as you know that, hitting United Arab Emirates by our drones and plastic missiles stopped for like 2 or 2.5 years because UAE just showed that they are a little bit out of the conflict in Yemen. I know it was like a deceiving reaction that they are trying to vote for the international community and trying to vote for Yemenis so they don't get hit by our drones and plastic missiles. But now, after they got back to the ground with the very, very hard operation on the ground. They took over, as I told you, they took over some areas in Shabwa district, and they are trying to just go back to the to their tight alliance with Saudi Arabia, invading our countries and killing our people. So this had to be faced with a reaction from Sana'a, which was committing an operation towards Abu Dhabi and hitting some very important facilities in there. Yeah, this is the reason why. You know, if you just separate a little bit between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, we are in the middle of, you know, firing battle with Saudi Arabia. It didn't stop for the seven continuous years, but UAE had to go back for this battle for their own reasons. I think the Israeli and the American are putting pressure on UAE to go back to the battle because Saudi Arabia now is facing a very hard situation in Yemen alone. That's why they brought the troops back to Yemen and fought again in Yemen. And of course, like Saudi Arabia are being hit every single day, maybe because of the continuous air raids and continuous crimes against the people of Yemen. So United Arab Emirates are going to face the same problem from Yemen, of course.
Yeah, and when we talk about the Emirates and Abu Dhabi facing a reaction, just recently there was a strike all the way in Abu Dhabi by Yemeni forces. What kind of message do you think that sends to the Emiratis, and what kind of impact do you think it has on their morale and on how they're acting now on the battlefield?
Well, you know, as United Arab Emirates are weaker to face such reaction or to face such operations against its own security and economic facilities. You know, because Saudi Arabia is maybe geographically is a bigger country, they can somehow stand for several operations and just take more and more operations inside or deep inside the country of Saudi Arabia. But United Arab Emirates cannot maybe take more or three such operations inside Abu Dhabi or Dubai, for example, you know, because if this really happens, the insecurity situation will just wipe away all the investors out of the country, and it will be a very bad situation for United Arab Emirates. And I think why United Arab Emirates are trying now to put the blame on Yemen or Sana'a for the intensifying operation, the backlash it's just, you know, it's our right to defend our country. It's not like we want war. It's like that we are seeking for more wars. We are, the Yemeni people are being more, the one who are being killed, the one who are being sick, are being prevented from their essential needs. They are not able to have even a fuel right now. Hospitals are being, a shortage of fuel. They're being blocked. Besides that, they're being targeted, the hospitals and all the infrastructures in Yemen. But I think if United Arab Emirates continues these continuous crimes, recent crimes like what happened yesterday in Sana'a, what happened in Hodeida and other and so many countries and so many districts inside the country, they will face even more operations inside their country, and the Yemeni military will just carry out more operations into Abu Dhabi or into Dubai or any place they choose to just, to make or to put some pilots in this path.
Do you think that these strikes from this week by the Saudis are sort of, a form of revenge for the strike on Abu Dhabi?
Well, I think it's an Emirati airstrikes in the first place, not only Saudi airstrikes nowadays. In the recent 3 days after the operation took place in Abu Dhabi, because, as long as they have a green light from the international community and they have the green light from the United States of America, which is covering all the crimes in the United Nations or in the United Nations Security Council, while the people of Yemen are getting targeted and over 70 persons were killed in one single day, the United Nations Security Council condemned our right to defend ourselves. They did not condemn these crimes against humanity in Yemen. And this is right. The double standard that the international community is trying to put in the whole picture of what's going on in Yemen. So what I really think is that Saudi Arabia and UAE are not going to reach anything with their intensifying crimes against the people of Yemen. They will just put more reasons to be hit back into their own country, into their own cities, and into their own security and economic stability that they are always paying for.
Yeah, there's one thing that comes to mind. There was a Saudi ship that was seized by Yemeni forces, which the Saudis claimed was carrying medical supplies. Was it really medical supplies or something else?
Well, that was so funny, just declaring that it's carrying some like medical supplies, footage that have been disclosed by the military of Yemen showed that this ship was carrying weapons, was carrying like vehicles, military vehicles, armored vehicles. It was carrying also radar machines, a very hard war machines. They were not like medical supplies, like they say, because, and even the international community could not accept this justifications from the Saudi Arabia, because they saw the pictures and they saw the footage, and they also called for immediate cessation of the ship, but they did not say whether it's really carrying like medical supplements for what they call is a hospital. It's not right, and if it was right, of course, they don't even have the right to go across within the water of, within the sovereignty of Yemeni water. They got close to the water that have been taken over from the Yemeni authorities, and this is not acceptable. If they really want to, just provide some like medical supplements to their affiliates or to their troops.
When you mentioned the port of Hodeidah, this terrible bombing, we have a prison being bombed, at least 70 people being killed, and also the telecommunications. All of Yemen has had its internet cut off. Can you tell us how the situation is? Are other Yemenis able to speak with their families? Do you have any means of finding out what's actually happening on the ground?
Well, I was trying to reach out my family since like 18 hours from now. It's very hard now to reach the family. Trying to call them by phones, but by cell phone is not able for now because of the airstrike that targeted all the telecom companies facility in Hodeidah, and it's the main gate that provides internet access to everywhere in Yemen. So now it's a whole blackout of internet access in the country. We don't know whether our families are safe or not, because the airstrikes continues in the country. We really don't know what's the situation in Yemen. We can't reach out to our families, our mothers, our siblings. And for me, the situation for me is the same for hundreds of thousands of people outside the country. They cannot reach millions in Yemen to see how they are doing while the bombing is still taking place intensively in the country, all over the country, from Sada to Sana'a to Hodeidah to everywhere, every village, every city, every neighborhood has been targeted by Saudi Arabia airstrike right now. But I hope that our families are safe, and I wish we can reach out to them very soon if it gets fixed, the internet connection to Yemen. And this is really added to the war crimes that have been committed inside my country. Saudi Arabia knows that they are targeting an infrastructure and facility of telecommunication. They want the internet to be cut off, so they cannot be their crimes cannot be covered to the whole world, and the whole country cannot see what's going on in Yemen. And that's the main reason. And I think they will not be able to hide their crimes for a long time, because everyone in the world now is talking about how criminal they are and how crimes in Yemen are so brutal.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you're able to reach your family soon and everyone else, and that this bloody war comes to an end. So these Western countries make exorbitant amounts of money from selling weaponry, which they know is used to make the world's worst humanitarian crisis even worse, but then they go ahead and do it anyway. It's so obvious that the term human rights is an arbitrary term that's cynically used by the West. They don't care about the human rights of the Yemenis that they kill, or the Syrians, the Venezuelans, the Iranians, the Cubans that they've killed. If you don't bend the knee to Western interests, if you want to be independent and free from neocolonialism, then you have no human rights. Now, obviously, the strike on Abu Dhabi didn't cause any major damage to the Emiratis or completely cripple their war effort, but it did send a very potent message, and it did open a new front in the war. The Yemenis have shown that they are able to strike deep within enemy territory, all the way from home, thousands of kilometers away. It is a game changer, whether people realize it or not. And it shows that the tide of the war is turning. Yemen has become a quagmire for the Saudis and their coalition. This is a fight that they cannot win. This war has been going on for 7 years. If the Yemenis didn't already surrender in the face of such adversity, after so much famine, so much suffering, then they're certainly not going to surrender now. Despite all their efforts, the axis of resistance, of which Yemen is an integral, essential part, is in fact stronger today than ever before. And neither Saudi Arabia nor the Emirates can crush it, no matter how many American and British bombs they buy. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
In the public sphere, aerial photography and satellite images are censored by the US government, thus Google, Facebook et al., creating a situation where Palestinians are alienated from their own cartography. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jim Miles Ryder. This article is published under the heading Between a Rising Tide and Apartheid: Environmental Justice in Palestine. Stay tuned for more. A recent seminar from the group Visualizing Palestine served to present four graphic representations of environmental problems within Palestine. The graphics are self-explanatory and need no review here. They're after all graphic and speak well for themselves. The discussion talked around the graphics, what they emphasize, and how they are necessary for a clear understanding of environmental issues in Palestine. The overriding message of the environmental perspective of the discussion is that it cannot be separated from the colonial settler geopolitical message. Colonial settler actions are destructive and extractive for indigenous environments, whether in Palestine or in other areas of European Western conquest. While not described as such, the presentation very well fits under the academic rubric of cultural geography, the effects of culture on geography and its corollary, how changes to geographical situations are used to create a dominant culture. One of the recurring issues was presenting maps, a graphic that can reveal much about colonial destruction, settler extraction, and attempts to greenwash settler actions. In the public sphere, aerial photography and satellite images are censored by the US government, thus Google, Facebook et al., creating a situation where Palestinians are alienated from their own cartography. This has two main components. First, after the Nakba and the destruction of over 500 villages and towns, the Israelis researched all Arab place names to be replaced with Hebraized or biblical names. Most of the villages destroyed were completely demolished, completely erased through manipulations of the map. Further, more than 180 were concealed by parks and reserves using non-native species planted on the land to conceal its original occupation. The fake regime of Israel has used this in a form of greenwashing, able to boast about the many trees it has planted and the forests and parks it has created, all the while eliminating any trace of indigenous land. Most people probably do not see this as an environmental issue per se, but the environment cannot be separated from earlier the geography or the culture of a place. The land is the people. These spatial representations make the visualizing of Palestine objective and factual. The one graphic map on hazardous waste sites fully demonstrates the toxic occupation of Palestinian lands. The most compelling statement made during the discussion on cartography was the settler colonial imperative is to create private land for profit, a strong summation. Climate change and environmental damage affect women and youth severely. Childhood diseases due to malnutrition and poor water quality, particularly mentioned in Gaza, affects women as caregivers. Recent heat waves, the loss of electricity, and the density of refugee settlements have exacerbated women's access to healthcare facilities and information. Women working in agriculture are not considered in studies and research. After displacement due to flooding, women do double the work and most of the family recovery. All this, heat, floods, poor agricultural compensation, all have the most impact on women and thus the families they support. The discussion on youth and environment centered on the question of why or why not Palestinian young people would participate.